Hi, this is Donna Hudson with the News Gazette for July 30th, 2026. Starting on page one, here's an article about the Catlin Village Board. Solar farm moratorium extended to August's end. Officials say they need more time to update zoning ordinance. This article is by Jennifer Bailey. Dateline Catlin. 40-year electrical contractor Jay Martin, who lives along Catlin-Tilton Road, says he gets along just fine with the corn and beans now surrounding him, but he's not sure how that would change if the fields across the street were filled with solar panels. "It's nice and quiet and peaceful," Martin said of the life he's led there for 17 years. He said he's worried that if a solar farm goes in, the owners won't take care of the property. Not addressing the weeds can lead to bugs and other issues, he said. He is of the opinion that solar farms should be out in the desert. As Earthrise Energy continues to wait on local zoning approvals regarding its proposed 1,400-acre solar farm project along Catlin-Tilton Road, the Catlin Village Board extended its solar farm moratorium again Tuesday night to August 31. Tilton's moratorium expired July 1. Catlin Village Clerk Autumn Lang said, "We're still working on that," in reference to updating the relevant zoning requirements, thus prompting the council to extend the moratorium. Village officials said they think another 30 days should be enough time as they continue to work with a specialized Springfield attorney on the zoning ordinance changes. The action was similar to a decision made last month. Earthrise Energy's counsel has indicated the company's patience is limited and is considering legal action. Catlin board members have said they are developing new language addressing an industrial-scale solar and wind farms to focus on health, safety, and setbacks. Tilton Mayor Billy Ware said all of his village's updates came with approval of its zoning comprehensive plan. "We let it expire," Ware said of the solar moratorium. "We have a half-mile boundary for future development." Under Earthrise's proposed project, the nearest solar panel for Tilton residents would be more than a half-mile away. Many other residents have been outspoken about not wanting solar farms taking up more farmland. Those against Earthrise's project include Catlin-Tilton Road resident Sloan Anderson and rural Catlin resident Patty Jones. Anderson, a Tilton resident living in Catlin Township, who has "Say No to Solar Farms" signs on his property, said, "People against it have banded together and stuck together through this whole process during the last year and a half to 2 years." He said, "Some people may not be as public about their opposition, but have remained more behind the scenes. Groundwater testing is the big concern with the shallow aquifer in the area," Anderson said. "He's not on a well, but all his neighbors are," he said. He's also concerned about noise pollution and other issues. Jones, who stands to have solar panels on two sides of her property, added that people who support the project think they're going to get a lot of money from it, but there are no guarantees. Earthrise could walk off the project and sell it, she said. She also said the company's financial agreement with the school district is basically a bribe with upfront money, not new or additional revenue. The Salt Fork School District earlier this year signed a letter of intent with Earthrise outlining a future tax abatement agreement. It said, "We'll provide earlier access to more than $3.5 million in expected property tax revenue within the first 2 years of the solar project's operation." Jones is against the project because, number one, it will put it on prime soil. "It's a national security issue," she said. "With less soil to grow crops on, sooner or later you're not able to feed yourself," Jones said. She added that all of this also is detrimental to the wind, ground, environment, water, and we have no clue what it will do to the wells. "Property values are going to go down," Jones said. In November, Earthrise submitted applications for special use permits to Catlin and Tilton, stating that once the moratoriums on solar farms are lifted, the applications can be revised to align with any updated zoning requirements. The next article on page one is about the Illinois Amish Heritage Center, Living History, 10,000 square foot museum and visitor center plans October soft opening, by Jana Wiersma. Dateline Arthur. How many visitors does the Illinois Amish Heritage Center see each year? About 2,500 to 3,000, said Executive Director David King. As for the center's steam threshing show, which is set for this Friday and Saturday, the event is expected to bring in 1,200 to 1,500 people, hopefully closer to the latter if the weather is good. And now for the $3.6 million question. How many people are expected to visit the new 10,000 square foot museum and visitor center once it's up and running? A market study showed that the facility could attract 20,000 people annually once it's fully open, King said. He added that going from 3,000 to 20,000 visitors is probably not going to happen in 1 year, but within probably 2 or 3 years. The Heritage Center hopes to hold a soft opening in October that will include a temporary exhibit in the museum's lobby, King said. However, much of the building will remain closed to the public at that time as work continues. The rest of construction could be completed by May, said construction manager Ed Yoder, owner of Dagny Builders. While the Heritage Center is currently open only on Saturdays from May through October, the museum will be open 6 days a week, pretty much year-round, King said. The Heritage Center opened in 1994 and includes the 1865 Yoder House, the 1870s Schrock Home, and the 1879 Hirschberger Miller Barn. The Museum and Visitor Center broke ground in April 2025 with a ceremony featuring a horse-powered Amish slip scraper. According to King and Yoder, the facility will include a hall for the main exhibit, a hall for changing exhibits, a library with a genealogy research area, a gift shop, a theater for educational videos, a workshop for preparing artifacts for display or storage, and restrooms. King noted that the lobby will be able to host events, and the building will include a catering kitchen for food prepared off-site. The project cost is approximately $3.6 million, and the Heritage Center has raised half of that amount, he said. Fundraising is picking up again, King said. It was slower when we hadn't broken ground. He estimates it'll take about 12 more months to raise the rest of the funds, and one donor has committed to a major gift at the campaign's end to help the center reach the finish line. More information about how to give is available at illinoisamish.org/donate. The project has been awarded a $500,000 state grant, per the center's website. Yoder, who grew up Amish, said that some people are fascinated by the lifestyle because they yearn for what appears to be a simpler way of life as things become increasingly more fast-paced. It may be somewhat of a misperception as well, because they're not slowing down either, he said of the Amish. But it's a much more slow-paced lifestyle. Their lives are simple on the surface, but also complex, King said. Next article from page one is about the Champaign County Court. Champaign woman arrested on DUI charge for fourth time this year, by Luke Taylor. Dateline Urbana. A Champaign woman may be facing jail time after she was arrested for allegedly driving under the influence for the fourth time this year. Lorea Ahmad, 49, was on probation for a July 16 DUI arrest when she was arrested after a traffic stop Tuesday night. She appeared in arraignment court Wednesday, where Assistant State's Attorney Eileen Keeley said the state would be requesting that her pretrial release from the July 16 case be revoked. Champaign County Sheriff's deputies said they conducted a traffic stop at 8:39 p.m. Tuesday in the 1300 block of Savoy Plaza Lane after witnessing multiple violations. Healy said that they had observed a vehicle drifting entirely over the center lines of the road, traveling down the opposite lane in the wrong direction for several feet, and then eventually correcting back to the right lane. During the stop, the deputies found that the driver, Ahmad, had multiple indicators of impairment and visible smoking pipes with suspected drug residue in the vehicle. Ahmad admitted to consuming crack cocaine and heroin prior to driving the vehicle, according to the deputies. Keeley said that Ahmad first claimed she had consumed the drugs that morning, but as deputies pointed out clear signs of impairment, she eventually said it had been only a few hours earlier. Ahmad consented to a search of her vehicle and person and admitted to having a pack of heroin in her bra. Deputies found at least 8 smoking pipes with suspected drug residue, as well as cannabis and ammunition in the vehicle. Keeley said Ahmad denied any knowledge of the ammunition and that she does not have a valid FOID card. Ahmad was charged with 2 counts of aggravated driving under the influence, 1 of possessing a controlled substance, and 1 of driving on a revoked license. State's attorney Julia Reitz said that Ahmad's first arrest on charges of driving under the influence of drugs and possession of controlled substances this year was on January 10th, and she was released on conditions 2 days later. She said Ahmad failed to appear at her next court date, and a warrant was issued for her arrest. She later appeared and was released again. On April 10th, she was arrested again on charges of driving under the influence of drugs. At that time, the state filed a petition to revoke her license in the January case, which was granted. Later that month, she pleaded guilty in both cases and was sentenced to 24 months of probation, ordered to pursue treatment, and barred from using illegal substances. Ahmad's driver's license was revoked based on that conviction as well, Reitz said. On July 16th, Champaign police found Ahmad asleep in a vehicle on the 2300 block of Springfield Avenue and arrested her. She was then charged with aggravated driving under the influence of drugs and driving with a revoked license. Despite the prior cases, Reitz said, those are not detainable offenses, so she was released under the Pretrial Fairness Act. The new charges from this week are also not detainable offenses, but they allowed the state to file a petition to revoke her release in the previous case. A hearing on that matter is scheduled for this morning. Reitz said Ahmad has no prior criminal history after 2005. The fact is that under the Pretrial Fairness Act, driving under the influence is not a detainable offense unless there is a victim who suffers great bodily harm or the defendant has 5 prior convictions for driving under the influence, making it a Class X non-probationable felony, Reitz said. We have been and will continue to do what we can within the limits of the law to keep the public safe from the danger she presents. Moving on to the Nation and World page, this next article is on the Mideast conflict, expanding hostilities. Iran launches renewed missile attacks as U.S. and Saudis strike Tehran-backed militias in Iraq. Dateline Baghdad. This article is written by the AP. Iran launched a barrage of missiles at American forces in the Middle East on Wednesday as the U.S. partnered with Saudi Arabia to strike Tehran-backed militias in neighboring Iraq, killing at least 20 fighters and 6 Iranian advisors. Elsewhere, drone strikes ignited fires on 2 natural gas vessels at the Egyptian port of Damietta, according to Embraer, a British maritime security firm. It was not immediately clear who was responsible for the strikes on a U.S.-owned floating storage facility and a Greek-owned tanker. No injuries were reported. The flare-up on multiple fronts after several days of relative calm raised the risk of a return to all-out war. It also underscored the difficulty of winding down a 5-month conflict that has jolted the world economy and is unpopular among Americans. The fighting was also likely to add to concerns that the U.S. is further drawing down already diminished stockpiles of sophisticated munitions needed to defend its bases and allies. Egypt, a close U.S. ally and regional mediator, is one of the only countries in the Middle East to have been spared direct military action during the war. A strike by Iran or its allies, if confirmed, would mark a significant widening of the conflict. Meanwhile, a Fox News reporter said in an on-air segment that he spoke with President Donald Trump, who, using a series of vulgarities, told him the U.S. will hit back hard in response to the Iranian attacks. Saudi Arabia had accused the Iraqi militias of sending drones to attack its oil facilities over the past 2 days. An umbrella group of Iraqi militias initially denied the allegations, while another Iran-backed group, the Houthi rebels in Yemen, said they had attacked Saudi energy facilities as part of a separate but related conflict. Before the latest eruption, mediators had expressed optimism about bringing the U.S. and Iran back to the negotiating table. An interim agreement collapsed in recent weeks over renewed fighting in the Strait of Hormuz, a crucial waterway for global energy supplies that Iranian attacks have again effectively closed. A regional official said mediators are still trying with both sides to restore calm and get the ceasefire back on track. He gave no details on whether progress was being made and spoke on condition of anonymity to discuss the closed-door diplomacy. Iran's paramilitary Revolutionary Guard said it fired ballistic missiles at Jordan's Muwafaq Salti Air Base, a key U.S. military hub for the region, in a statement carried by the state-run IRNA news agency. Jordan's military said 5 Iranian missiles had been intercepted and destroyed. There were no immediate reports of casualties or damage. The U.S. military later announced that American and Saudi fighter aircraft had struck multiple logistics and weapons sites in eastern Iraq in response to the alleged drone attacks on Saudi Arabia. The Saudi Defense Ministry warned that it does not seek escalation, but will respond to any aggression. The Popular Mobilization Forces, a coalition of primarily Shiite Iran-backed armed groups that is officially under the command of the Iraqi military, said at least 20 fighters were killed and 32 others wounded in the overnight strikes. 2 Iraqi militia officials told the Associated Press that 6 Iranian advisors were also killed. They spoke on condition of anonymity because they were not authorized to comment publicly. The coalition joined the fight against the Islamic State group after it seized large sections of Iraq in 2014. The Iraqi government later designated the coalition as an independent military formation within the armed forces, but the militias have significant autonomy and some have attacked U.S. facilities. Iran's government decried the U.S.-Saudi attacks, though the Fox News reporter said Trump told him they were done in coordination with the Iraqi government. The office of Iraqi President Nizar Amidi called the airstrikes a blatant violation of Iraq's sovereignty. Iraq's National Security Council said the strikes had been carried out while the Iraqi government was in contact with relevant parties to investigate and address all the concerns raised by the Saudi and American sides. It said a number of innocent people had been killed and wounded. A visit to Saudi Arabia by Iraqi Prime Minister Ali al-Azadi said A visit to Saudi Arabia by Iraqi Prime Minister Ali al-Zadi that had been scheduled for today was postponed indefinitely, said 2 Iraqi government officials on condition of anonymity because they were not authorized to comment publicly. Saudi Arabia is also locked in a renewed conflict with the Houthis. The rebels have declared a blockade of Saudi shipping that could choke off another crucial Middle East trade route, the Bab el-Mandeb Strait from the Red Sea to the Gulf of Aden. On Monday, the Houthis said they had launched drones targeting oil facilities used to transport oil across Saudi Arabia to the Red Sea port of Yanbu, a key bypass for Saudi exports blocked by Iran's chokehold on the Strait of Hormuz. The rebels said their attack was in response to a Saudi drone that had breached Yemen's airspace. Continuing on page 4 with Nation and World Stories, Fauci repeatedly invokes Fifth Amendment in contentious hearing. Dateline Washington. Dr. Anthony Fauci repeatedly invoked the Fifth Amendment Wednesday and declined to answer dozens of questions from senators in a Republican-led committee hearing about his handling of the COVID-19 pandemic. The decision, at least for now, shielded Fauci from answering questions that could expose him to accusations of lying under oath. Though he received a pardon in early 2025 from Democratic President Joe Biden, some Republicans pursuing a years-long campaign for his arrest had suggested he could still face charges for any perjury committed during Wednesday's hearing. The scientist who helped lead the nation's COVID-19 response was subpoenaed to testify under oath by Republican Senator Rand Paul of Kentucky, who has long had an antagonistic relationship with Fauci. In response to angry, sometimes mocking questions from Republican senators, Fauci declined to answer more than 100 times, injecting new drama into partisan divides that have festered for years about the origins and handling of the pandemic. Fauci himself has become a polarizing figure, even receiving death threats that prompted him to seek security. In his opening statement, Fauci said Paul has an obvious obsession with calling for my prosecution. The only conclusion I can reach is that the sole reason he is calling me before this committee is to get me to say something, anything, that could vindicate his repeated public pledges that I end up, in his words, quote, behind bars, unquote, Fauci said, adding that while it pained him to do so, he was following his attorney's advice by taking the Paul, who has long argued that Fauci should be criminally investigated based on his belief that the scientist was dishonest in previous testimony to Congress, announced that the committee will vote next week on whether to hold Fauci in contempt for declining to answer questions. He did not say whether he would push for a criminal contempt referral to federal prosecutors or another charge. He also raised questions about whether Fauci's pardon affects his eligibility for Fifth Amendment protections. Next article from the U.S. Supreme Court. Trump asks for an $83 million defamation verdict to be tossed. Dateline Washington. President Donald Trump and the Justice Department are asking the Supreme Court to toss an $83 million defamation verdict won by writer E. Jean Carroll after she accused him of sexual assault, saying that he can't be sued for comments he made while president. It's the second time Trump has asked the justices to nix damages awarded by a jury to Carroll, a longtime advice columnist and talk show host. The Supreme Court refused in June to hear his appeal of another verdict for $5 million found him liable for sexual abuse and defamation. The latest case centers on comments Trump made during his first term as president. The Justice Department wants to invoke the Westfall Act, which shields government employees from being sued for doing their jobs. Absent this court's intervention, the sitting president is facing nearly $100 million of personal liability for conduct that was well within the scope of his federal office, federal attorneys wrote. That alone deserves this court's attention. The documents were reviewed Wednesday by the AP and expected to be formally docketed within the court shortly. Trump's lawyers, meanwhile, argued that an appeals court engaged in procedural contortions to avoid addressing Trump's claims that presidential immunity protects him because he made the statements in question in 2019 during his first term. Our next article from the Nation and World page is entitled Europe Burning. Three firefighters die fighting blaze on Greek island of Crete as large wildfire in southwestern France threatens to surge. Dateline Liège-Cap-Ferré, France. An uncontained wildfire, four times the size of Paris, threatened to surge again Wednesday in southwest France as three firefighters died in Greece and crews across southern Europe confronted a punishing mix of heat, drought, and strong winds. The deaths on Crete brought a fatal new dimension to a wildfire emergency stretching from the Atlantic coast to the eastern Mediterranean. At the peak of the evacuations, a third of a million people were driven from homes and vacation sites in France and Spain. In France's Gironde region, the country's biggest blaze had not spread during a calm night, authorities said, but as temperatures reached 104 degrees Fahrenheit Wednesday afternoon and winds strengthened, the reprieve threatened to be short-lived. The landscape was so combustible that investigators believe routine brush clearing work near a high voltage line may have sparked the inferno, even though the work appeared to comply with regulations. At the command center in Liège, firefighters bent over maps spread across a car hood, tracking three danger zones: northern Cap Ferret, the wooded corridor around Marche-Prime, Kestis, and Saint-Jean-de-Lac, and a military site near Martignas, where a major outbreak forced a large deployment. More than 2,000 firefighters and over 20 aircraft remained mobilized, backed by crews from across France and European partners. "We strike quickly and strike hard at any new smoke emissions," Gironde Fire Commander Mathieu Jomain said. Beyond the command center, civilians were trying to hold the line themselves. At Souge, volunteers flooded the edges of dirt tracks while a local digger driver plowed through still-burning soil, trying to keep flames from crossing back when the expected western wind arrived. In Lacnau, residents pumped water from a lake into tanks headed for hotspots and firefighters' cisterns. "If one day the fire starts in our neck of the woods, I know very well that all the people here would do the same for us," said Flavien Debouche, 33, who drove from Saint-Emilion with his father to help. The advance of major fires in the Landes and Var regions has been halted. That left Gironde as France's biggest remaining wildfire battle, Interior Minister Laurent Nunez said. In Greece, two firefighters died Wednesday while battling a wildfire in the Rethymno region of Crete, Greece's fire department said. They were among about 125 firefighters confronting flames fanned by strong winds, with four helicopters and four water-dropping planes deployed. The circumstances of their deaths were not immediately clear. The department said they died in the line of duty to protect the lives and property of citizens and the natural environment. A third firefighter died outside the fire perimeter after tackling a separate blaze in the southern Peloponnese region. Next article, Musk's firm sues Minnesota over ban on nudification. Dateline Minneapolis. Elon Musk's ex-AI has sued Minnesota over the state's first-in-the-nation law that bans nudification technology on websites and apps, potentially providing a test for how far states can go in constitutionally regulating the use of artificial intelligence. Musk's company sued Monday in federal court, days before the law is set to take effect Saturday and make Minnesota the first state to try to outlaw the increasingly proliferating technology that lets people use AI to create fake nude images of real people. The law was signed in May. In the 38-page lawsuit, XIA, whose AI model chatbot and image generator Grok is available on Twitter and elsewhere, said it does not contest the state's interest in banning the distribution of AI-generated nude images of real people without their consent. But it said Minnesota's law extends far beyond that goal, banning many constitutionally protected images and video, and subjecting the company to a penalty of $500,000 per violation. The lawsuit argues there is no safe harbor provision for companies that make good faith efforts to prevent such images from being created, and that it covers images that were consented to or even created by the depicted person. It also says the law's definition of intimate part is overly broad, covering body parts that are routinely displayed in public. In a statement, Minnesota Attorney General Keith Ellison said his office had not yet been served with the lawsuit. "But I know that using AI to create nude images of people against their will is appalling," he said. "There are plenty of worthy debates to have about AI policy. This is not one of them. AI nudification robs the target of their dignity and can cause immense harm on an emotional, personal, and professional level. State laws over election deepfakes have had mixed results in courts. California's law was blocked over First Amendment speech protections. Minnesota's law has thus far survived a 2025 court challenge by Musk's company. The law is distinct from others that outlaw deepfakes, AI-generated sexually explicit images of people without their consent. Those typically penalize the people who use the tools to make these images, not the makers of the tools themselves.